Everybody, I'm Beatty Cohen Fredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beatty Show. And yes, I always have a smile on my face when I listen to my intro music. Well, as many of you know who've been listening to the Ask Beatty Show now for many years, I am a psychotherapist, a sex therapist, the author of the book For Better, For Worse, Forever: Discover the Path to Lasting Love. I am actually the new advice columnist for Dan's newspaper in the Hamptons. I'm a national speaker, national radio and television expert guest. And when I think about it now, I have been hosting the Ask Beatty Show here on the Progressive Radio Network since 2013. It's like, where has the time gone? And I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton. So what is the Ask Beatty Show really all about? Well, it's about you. It's about empowerment. We talk about all of the things that we can do, not just talk about, not just complain about, that can actually improve the quality of our lives and relationships. And of course, the key word is do, which is what I ask my patients to do after every single session. I want them, regardless of their problems, whether it's relationship problems or sexual issues or addictions of various different kinds or depression or anxiety, I ask my patients, and of course, I ask you, to be mindful every single day, and that probably means multiple times during the day, to be cognizant that you are living your life, that you are navigating your life in ways that are in your best interest, and that you are mindful and hopefully very self-aware. And if you haven't been self-aware, hopefully you are becoming more self-aware of not engaging in self-destructive or destructive or self-sabotaging behaviors. So on this show, we talk a lot about mental health and sexuality and relationships. And of course, my mantra, because we all have issues. There is nobody, not therapists, there is nobody who is immune from life's challenges and life's issues. But the real question that we all have to really think about and ponder is whether or not, whether we're having serious problems or whether or not we're just feeling really out of sort for a variety of reasons, whether or not we are really willing to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can the issues and the problems that continue to get in the way of our life, to be able to live happy and joyful lives. And of course, this means that we can't change our history. And a lot of people who I treat have come from very, very dysfunctional homes, abusive homes, and understandably so. There are going to always be scars, the depression, the anxiety, a lot of people trying to not think about their pain by using drugs and alcohol. But what I have found over the past 35 years, and every week when I say over 35 years, I can hardly believe where that time has gone. And of course, I've treated thousands and thousands of people with a variety of different emotional and psychological and psychiatric issues. But what I can tell you is that there is a way, a very successful way, again, even though we can't change what happened or what did not happen in our earlier lives, to emotionally work through as best as we possibly can the trauma, so that we are then able, maybe once and for all, to be able to live in the moment without having one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And it's a decision that we really all have to make, because what I see, and for most people, we have unfinished business or some skeletons in the closet. And depending on the severity of the unfinished business and the skeletons in the closet, it really does. They play havoc with our lives. And the idea of just keeping a stiff upper lip and not talking about the issues, I wish I could say that they just magically disappear on their own, but they are there, and they really do keep us from fully enjoying our life. And when you look at depression statistics in this country, 17 million adults in the United States suffering from clinical depression, 40 million Americans suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. And the statistics that have concerned me most recently is what is going on with suicide. I don't know whether you are aware, but every day, every single day, and I believe in the last couple of years, this number has really gone up, 130 Americans die by suicide. And again, this may be a surprising statistic to you, but did you know that suicide, it's the second leading cause of death in the world for those people age 15 to 24. When you think about a 15-year-old, a teenager who ideally is just starting life and looking forward to the future. And yet, you know, what I'm seeing, in fact, even in my own practice, I've had a couple of 15-year-olds who've actually took steps to really hurt themselves. Maybe they didn't want to kill themselves, but one person in particular, he stabbed himself with knives, you know, multiple times. And it was really fortunate that his parents were able to discover what was going on in his room before he did more harm to himself. So again, you know, when we get to a place in our lives where the depression is feeling out of control, or where we think about killing ourselves, and we may actually have made some gestures, The very best thing that we can do, of course, is reach out and ask for help. And in a few minutes, I'm going to be discussing what is going on in the world of teenage suicide. And my guest is going to be my husband, Jim Fredos, who is a sociologist, and he is also the host of the Radical Imagination television show on MNN TV. Just looking at what is happening with teenagers and suicide from a more sociological perspective, I think it's going to give us a lot of interesting insight. And then, of course, we look at what is going on in the world of relationships. I talk about the divorce statistics. They are very alarming and very upsetting. 48% of first marriages end in divorce. 67% of second marriages also end in divorce. And one would hope that after a first marriage and a second marriage, that maybe we would be doing better in our third marriages. And yet the reality is that 74% of people who are marrying for the third time end up in divorce as well. So what exactly is going on? Well, I have a lot of good news to share about the difficulties and challenges people are having in their relationships. And for those of you who listen to me every single week here on the Ask Beatty Show, you've probably heard this over and over and over again. But again, I feel it is definitely, definitely worth repeating. Given what's happened in the world of divorce and in the world of domestic violence, I mean, when you think about domestic violence and all of the self-help books and therapists and relationship coaches and movies about domestic violence and intimate partner violence, again, one would actually hope that we were seeing some reversal in these statistics. And yet the reality is that we are not. And three women are actually killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner. But when I go around the country talking about my program, Never Make a Mistake in Love Again, and this is based on my research and my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, and to my over 35 years of clinical practice, I have clarity. And that's really the good news. I mean, we can be wondering, oh, wow, why is this happening? You know, isn't this terrible? The divorce rate is so awful and the domestic violence statistics continue to soar. But I have good news to share with you if you're really willing to take it in. So if you ever want to have a successful relationship with anyone, a successful romantic love relationship with anyone, are you interested and are you willing to take in the three things that we all need to do to never make a mistake in love again? And there is no shortcut, my friends, to having to actually do the work that is involved in looking at these three different areas. And of course, the first is that each of us needs to be in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to be fully, you know, immune from having any problems, but we need to be stable. We need to have been willing to work through issues, the depression, the anxiety, the substance abuse, the sexual problems, the sexual abuse issues that really stem from our own family of origin, so that we are solid, so that we are in a good place, and that we are not entering a relationship because we're depressed or we're needy or we're lonely. And as I used to tell my daughter when she was a little girl, and of course I was trying to educate, and I probably over-educated or talked about all of this too much with my daughter, I've always said that the relationship needs to be the icing on the cake. And we need to be the cake. We need to be solid. We need to be solid so that a relationship is then going to add something to an already solid, happy person. And that means that we have a personal responsibility really to ourselves to take care of business, to take care of our unfinished business, to take care of our skeletons in the closet that get in the way of our life and will always get in the way of our relationships if we don't do something about dealing with the issues. So that's number one. And of course, number two, we need to be students of relationship education and have real clarity within ourselves about the ingredients that actually go into a healthy relationship. And I'm so impressed in my private practice right now in New York City and in East Hampton. I'm actually treating a number of young women in their mid-20s. And the common denominator with these women is that they are beautiful and they are smart and they are intelligent and they all have MBAs and they all have great jobs and money is not an issue. But the common thread is that none of them have ever learned anything about the ingredients that go into a healthy relationship, and all have been in pretty seriously abusive, either physically abusive or emotionally abusive relationships in the past. And I'm so proud of them. I think it takes a lot of courage, especially at that young age, to say, you know, I have some things to learn about relationships, and I am willing to take the time and actually do the work. So whether or not you're 25 or 35 or 75 or 85, if you are looking for love, and of course, in the final analysis, it really is, I think about love and healthy relationships, which of course impacts our physical health and our day-to-day, you know, really well-being. Do yourself a favor if you're interested in having a good relationship, and do some reading and take some of this in, so that you are going to be a person who is never going to make a mistake in love again. And then, of course, number three is my very unromantic, very unsexy formula that came about as a result of my research with 450 people in the Boston, Providence, Connecticut area. And I came up with a formula which culminated in the book, which teaches all of us how to actually assess. Yes, assess. It isn't sexy. It isn't lovey-dovey. It is not romantic. But when you think about it, we assess every single thing in our lives, our cell phones and our computers and our cars. We assess everything. And yet when it comes to our relationships, that is a word probably that most people, probably 99% of people, would never, ever, ever use. So this 10-step formula, it really takes you through all of the different areas that you do need to look at to educate yourself and empower yourself, and above all, keep yourself safe. Again, the formula, the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And one of the things that was very upsetting for me when I did the research was that I found that it takes about a year to find out who somebody really is and somebody who somebody is really not. And before I did all of this work, and I'm sure you can really relate to this, I would meet somebody and I would say, what a lovely woman, or what a lovely man, or what an honest person. And of course, what I've learned over the years is that I would never make that kind of a statement ever, ever, ever. And the best we can do when we meet people for the very first time and initially is to say, you know, I met somebody who appears to be great, who appears to be honest, who appears to be loving. And with my formula, which, by the way, you cannot fast forward this process, it is going to take about a year to find out who this person really is. Now, obviously, if you're seeing a lot of red flags, you're not going to stay in a red flag relationship, you know, for a year. But to feel empowered and to have real clarity about what is okay and not okay in our relationship, I can't think of anything really more important. Of course, that also holds true for the kind of lifestyle that we are living, that Gary Null talks about every single day, the importance of a plant-based diet, of the vegetables, of the grains, of the fish, the nuts, the herbs, the, you know, the supplements, and the importance of eating healthily and interacting and socializing with healthy people, not people who are going to make you crazy, and making sure that you're getting enough sleep, and if you're lucky, to be able to take naps. And, you know, again, I cannot stress the importance of exercise. I know it's played a huge, huge role in my own life, including weight training and yoga and meditation. And of course, the importance of having supportive people in our life and making sure that you are eliminating not only chemical toxins from your food, but also eliminating toxic people. You know, sometimes I'll hear from patients, well, he or she is really not that bad and is only poisonous a portion of the time. And the poison is really not all that bad because we have a lot of really good times. And of course, my retort to that is that a little bit of poison will kill you in the same way that a lot of poison will kill you. So please be mindful of the people who you have in your life. And, you know, with Thanksgiving just a couple of days away, I was thinking about, you know, some of the people who I treat were saying that they really are dreading, spending time with certain family members. Well, you don't have to spend, if you feel compelled that you need to spend time with family members or friends that you actually don't like and you actually may even dread, instead of spending hours and hours, if you feel that sort of compulsion to go, maybe you need to go for a half an hour and excuse yourself and then spend the rest of the day, even if it's by yourself, in a non-toxic, non-crazy making kind of an environment. You know, other things that I talk about a lot, of course, is dancing, listening to music, getting out into nature. And of course, more and more people, especially here on the Upper West Side here in New York City, you know, have dogs. And I think it's, of course, we have a Cha-Cha. And you know, what a great way, always being welcomed by somebody who is greeting you with a wagging tail. And of course, it's also a wonderful, wonderful way to be able to connect with other people as well in nature. But of course, if you're finding that all of these great tips are really not doing the trick for you, and if you're finding that the depression and anxiety and substance abuse issues are still not lifting, I hope that I have convinced you over all of these years that it is okay. It is okay that it is a strength and not a weakness to reach out and ask for help. And talking about reaching out and asking for help, I read a couple of articles recently about what's going on in the world of teenage suicide. And I am very, very concerned about what I am reading. In fact, last month, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the Children's Hospital Association, which collectively represent over 77,000 physicians and over 200 children's hospitals, declare children's mental health challenges amid, of course, the COVID pandemic, a national emergency. And the medical associations pointed to research from the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, and prevention, and found, listen to these statistics, that between March and October 2020, the proportion of mental health-related emergency departments visits increased 24% for children ages, now listen to this, 5 to 11, five-year-olds who are hurting themselves, and 31% for children ages 12 to 17 when compared to 2019. And in the first 6 months of this year, we're talking 2021, children's hospitals nationwide also reported a shocking 45% increase in the number of self-injury and suicide cases in children ages 5 to 17 years old compared to the same period in 2019. And this is according to Children's Hospital Association president, a woman named Amy Wimpy. So what is going on? I mean, we're recognizing, yes, that there is a crisis. So the medical associations, they've called on policymakers, and hopefully the policymakers are not going to just stand around debating policy issues, to help address the crisis by increasing federal funding to ensure that all families can actually access mental health services and supporting effective models of student mental health, social and emotional needs through the $122 billion in pandemic relief funding made available to state and local education teachers. And also the Biden administration, they have also pledged $85 million in funding at the start of the school year toward mental health awareness, treating and training in schools. So I think that the good news is that we are talking more and more and more about mental health, but clearly we need better integrated care. And by integrated care, we mean you put mental health where the kids are. I mean, I have been saying that for years as a former director of the Montreal School Social Services Program. I mean, this is where the kids, this is where they spend the majority of their time. So how important it is if the teachers are seeing the kids that they're simply not doing well, that they're withdrawn, that they're not interacting, that their grades are going down. I mean, that is the most logical place to be able to make a referral to a school psychologist or a school counselor. But however, the reality is that the school psychologist, certainly the way it was in Montreal, and I've spoken to a number of parents recently, I mean, they're mostly concerned with the kids' academic learning. And there are not enough school psychologists, and there are not enough school counselors in the schools at all. So it's one thing about talking about referring kids for mental health treatment, but if there aren't the resources, in fact, a current patient of mine, who is a girl of 15, she has been on a waiting list for a child center treatment center in the Hamptons now for over 3 months. And this is a young girl who actually made a couple of suicide, let's call them gestures. I'm not sure that they were actual attempts. So here she is on this waiting list and is being seen extremely infrequently by a school counselor who unfortunately is just not equipped, doesn't have the time, and is not equipped to deal with this young little girl's very, very serious, mental health issues. But right now, what I want to do is actually talk from a sociological perspective to my husband, Jim Bredos, who is a sociologist, a professor, and who is the host of a really great show. And if you've not watched The Radical Imagination on MNN, it is playing on multiple stations at many, many different times. And it is a great, great, great show. And you are a great husband, and I'm really glad to have you here.
It's a pleasure and a joy and a blessing as always, Beattie.
Well,
yes.
When you say that, you really sound like our friend Cornell, who talks about the blessings and the joys.
Well, I've come around here. I do feel blessed as well. So there.
Well, good. So this is an article I know you read this morning.
I did.
And I have read multiple times. It was in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Why are more Black kids suicidal? And this was the heading, a search for answers. And let me just read a couple of paragraphs here, and then we can discuss them. Joe was 17 when he decided life wasn't worth living. He was tired of the violence in his Boston neighborhood, where his older brother had spent more than a year recovering from a gunshot wound to his leg, and he was especially tired of the comments about his weight. He thought about ending his life if the bullying didn't stop. Those thoughts eventually became so pervasive that one day he came home from school and took a small handful of pills. But it was enough only to produce a bad stomachache. And months later, he was still feeling depressed, and he said to his father, "Let me go see a therapist. My head's not right," he told his father. "I'm having these thoughts of killing myself that you'd all better be, you'd all be better without me here." So Joe still remembers his father's response. The father says, "That's not true. We love you, but you want to talk to somebody and tell someone that they're going to think you're crazy. And just one more paragraph, and then I really want to hear your thoughts on this. One study of high school students, and this was published in September 2021, found that the Black teenagers surveyed were more likely than the white teenagers to have attempted suicide without first having suicidal thoughts or plans, because suicide screening questionnaires typically ask whether people are having suicidal thoughts, or they certainly should be asked these questions, or have made plans to hurt themselves. And more research is needed. But a government study conducted last year suggested that Black children and adolescents who died by suicide were more likely than white youths to have experienced a crisis in the 2 weeks before they died. So, Jim, look, you're an activist. You've been involved in the Black community and the brown community for your entire life. What do you make of this, that the that the suicide rate of Black children 5 to 12 was low, but it was nearly twice that of white children in the same age group. What is your sense as a sociologist about what is going on in the Black communities in terms of young teens thinking about and actually taking steps to hurt themselves and even kill themselves?
Well, I have been involved in all kinds of communities as well. As a sociologist, I have got around done a lot of research in a lot of different areas and communities. But yes, I have been involved and committed to the Black struggle for most of my life, and which most of my adult life. Yes, absolutely. Listen, the statistics you cite are astonishing in a sense. They're depressing, but they're not, they shouldn't be surprising to us. Where I would start as a sociologist, and we'll then work down to some of the paragraphs that you were talking about here, the individual family that you were talking about, is we live in a very, very dysfunctional, crazy-making society. That is rooted in irrational, barbaric, structural racism, structural poverty, which debilitates tens of millions of people of all colors, but disproportionately people of color, right, and young people especially. So I think we've got to start there and look at those who are really running the society and calling the shots, and look at the crazy making behavior that they have created and perpetuated. That's not to say that we all shouldn't be taking responsibility for some of our actions and so on. And this young kid that you're describing here sounds like has been going through an enormous amount of pain and trauma, and there's a lot to unpack there. He absolutely would need and should have a good therapist available to him. The fact is, remains that the number of Black psychologists, I think in the article said, was about 4% of the total population. So right then and there, you're dealing with a very small percentage of professionals that I think have the sort of, not that white therapists can't have cultural understanding as well, but I think, again, in particular, Black communities, they do want to go to somebody that does appreciate their culture and understand their situation. So that's a start. You touched on that as well. The resources need to be there. We need to have more people of color in the field. We have to have a lot more time and effort placed in the schools so that the kids, and I guess you're talking about public schools here, the counselors who are there are dealing with so many disabilities and young kids that are going through so much, which has only been exacerbated in the last 18 months with the epidemic. So there's a lot that's going on there. I certainly agree with you that we need better resources there. The mistrust that is there about showing one's feelings is also something that I think we can relate to racism in particular. You're not, and men in particular, not expected to do that as much. The father who responded also defensively, thinking that then he has some blame for all of this, is understandable, but again,
unfortunate
and wrong. Yeah. Because so there's so many things.
Because I wanted to cite,
to look at.
I just want to cite some other statistics. Again, very, very disturbing statistics from 2013 to 2019. The suicide rate of Black boys and men, 15 to 24, rose by 47%. And by 59% for Black girls and women of the same age. And adolescents of color who identify as LGBTQ may be especially at risk of a suicide attempt, according to a national survey. But despite the racial disparities and the fact that suicide is the second leading cause of death among all adolescents, there's been a dearth of research, actually, as you're saying, examining the racial and ethnic differences in youth suicide ideation plans or suicide attempt. And, you know, when we were talking before the show, I mean, what I'm seeing more and more, and I'm hearing certainly more and more on viewing it on television, is that mental health now, I think, is more in the forefront now than ever before. We're hearing commercials. We are seeing commercials. We are seeing celebrities come out more and more in the tennis world, in the acting world, about their own mental health issues. And that is all good and hopefully is having a real positive impact on people saying, hey, you know what? If a celebrity, you know, can come out and talk about his suicidal depression or addiction, then maybe it's okay for me to do the same.
Well, true, but also it depends on how all of this gets framed. When the tennis players come out, I think certainly Osaka has come out and pointed to the incredible pressures and business pressures, et cetera, on these top tennis pros and so on. So it's within a structure, and a very irrational, crazy making structure that many of these people are operating. So I think that first, again, has to be emphasized, that we are dealing with a society that is dysfunctioning at so many different levels. And it shouldn't be surprising that the symptoms come out in forms of mental illness and suicides and alcoholism and so on. Let me just also mention quickly here, too, that during the height of the civil rights movement in the 60s and so on, when so many young Black youths, young men and women, joined the movement, crime rates began to go down significantly. Suicide rates went down. Mm-hmm. Homicide rates. So there's got to be also positive channels for these young people to feel that their lives are empowered, that their lives are worth living, and so on and so on. That plays a big part. And now, saying all of that too, absolutely. And you know, I'm very pro-therapy on this. A really good therapist can perform remarkable work for people and help them through enormously difficult periods of their life. So that is absolutely necessary as well.
You know, and I'm wondering, you know, as you're talking about social movements, whether or not more and more youth, and of course we see this on television, we read about this, are actually becoming involved in Black Lives Matter, and there's camaraderie, and there's a cause, and you know.
But there's also enormous frustration and disappointment as they see time and time again the pushback to what they're saying. So again, at a macro level, I think there's so much to talk about that can help us understand the interactions that are going on here that you've described in this article. And I certainly agree with it.
Let me ask you this again. This was an article, and I am not sure, we should have checked it out, whether the writer, a Christine Caron, is Black or white. But listen to this. You know, one of the headlines in the article, it says, keeping your business out of the street. And this is what she says. She says, an American Psychological Association report found that only 4% of psychologists in the United States in 2015 were Black, even though Black people represent 13% of the population, and a similar disparity exists among social workers and psychiatrists. Now, and then she goes on to say, even when mental health professionals are available, research has shown, and I guess I'm really curious about the research, that Black adolescents' depression often goes untreated because of negative perceptions of services and providers or feelings of shame about experiencing depressive symptoms. I think that, that also holds true
by the kids themselves. Yeah.
Yes.
It's hard to get out of that, you know, not blaming oneself. And it's not the masculine thing to do, to admit one's weaknesses and so vulnerabilities.
But what about white kids and white teenagers?
It's a very vulnerable
period
of one's life. You're really in the middle twixt your family of origin and trying to establish yourself as a separate human being and what to do and how to get involved with people and professions and careers and so on. It's a very vulnerable period of time, a rootless period of time in a sense, a gnomic period, generally speaking. Let's keep in mind, too, also that suicide is still a very, very, very rare phenomenon. That's not to say that when we have these spikes, we shouldn't be concerned.
The spikes are significant, though.
Well, you have to look at the research and how long these studies were. The methodology, the longitudinal nature of them, and so on. But I'm not, for the sake of our talk today. There certainly is something to be concerned about.
Look at this, but Jim, from 2013 to 2019, the suicide rate, again, of Black boys and men, 15 to 24, rose by 47% and 59% for Black girls and women of the same age.
However, whether the author of this column is Black or white is irrelevant in a sense, but you see how it's been couched. Well, as you read it, it seems that, what's wrong with these people? What's wrong with these kids?
No, I would ask the question, what's wrong with our society?
Okay.
That this is what's going on. Well, I mean, really.
Yeah. And why we're responding to them in this way.
And why are they responding to going on in the world today in this way?
Such despair.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then there was another quote here, and I am going to check whether or not shouldn't be a difference whether or not the author of this piece, Christina Caron, is Black or white. But there's a quote here that actually, it bothers me. It says that Black families, quote, not this is not something that Beattie and Jim are saying, but it says Black families don't typically have literacy in discussing feelings with each other, Dr. Cypher said in an email. Right. There is also the strong value of keeping your business out of the street. And I wonder what, our friend Cornel West or Dr. William Barber or our friend Dr. Carl, I wonder what they would say.
Well,
those are all
basically professional, at this point, involved in activities. Although they are certainly identifying and certainly involved with the poor and disenfranchised, they are at a point in their lives where they have incorporated the idea that one should express one's feelings, and they have the education and the literacy to do that.
Well, they have politically and they have their own professions, but I'm wondering what they would say about this piece, that somehow there's something intrinsic in the Black family.
I don't think they would say, or
because I would just agree with it.
Well, yeah, I would too. I don't think the article is necessarily saying that there's something intrinsically wrong. It's within certain cultural spheres, cutting across racial lines. You could do it within Jews or white ethnics, Italians, and so on, that are more receptive to the idea of going to therapy than those who aren't, and who are. There's a conversation about it within the school environment. I mean, you go to some of the, let's say, more elitist prep schools and so on, and colleges and so on. They will talk among themselves. Well, you know. Yeah, I go to Dr. So-and-so, and he's pretty good. But,
if you can afford to go.
But even the conversation that happens,
which
is not going to happen in other areas, other communities. It's something that's foreign. It's something you're supposed to tough things out. And that goes for the white ethnics, too.
But I wonder whether, and this would be something,
which I disagree with. I'm with you on this, that people should, especially men, open up and seek help for their conflicts and contradictions.
I think it would be really interesting, and I don't know anybody, but, to interview some young Black teenagers and white teenagers, and ask them about mental health and how they feel about seeking help for problems, whether or not it's seen to be something that's uncool, and whether or not it's perceived as a weakness.
Let me say this. The American mental health has by and large been a middle to upper middle class, not only field, but people who went to it were from that field, from that class. It was a luxury in a sense. I mean, what you're talking about when you deal with a lot of working class and poor people is the struggle to just survive, to get through the next day and to pay the rent and so on, get some sort of job and this and that, and deal with the immediate crises that are going on in the household.
But let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. You teach students. You taught at
number of different
multiple
places.
Different institutions in college. Mm-hmm. And do the kids, the students, do they ever say to you, I'm having trouble handing in my paper on time because somebody in my family is going through a bad time in terms of depression, or there's been psychiatric problems? Does it ever come up?
It comes up a lot. There's all kinds of, I take my students at face value here and their honesty, although some of the stories get a little far-fetched, but my uncle couldn't get to the bed.
They talk about it
oftentimes when they after miss an exam or something,
issues ever come up in conversation?
Let me tell you, when I taught at Yeshiva University for over 10 years, came up a lot because I was also a student counselor there or counselor of sorts and helping them sign up for various classes and their programs and so on. And that came up a lot within that community. Now, a place like John Jay, when I taught there, not as much, even though many of those students had similar or certainly issues that needed to be addressed. Absolutely. But again, we're talking about students who are often trying to finance their own education, who are working two jobs and so on, trying to get through the semester and go on and on.
I have a question at John Jay.
Yeah.
Okay. And you were there for a long time. Do they have a very large counseling center? Do you know?
I'm sure it has expanded. I was going to make a little crack about the counseling center for the academics, which is an administration, but leave that alone. They certainly could have used.
Do you know?
Yeah. Okay. well, Of course they do. Of course they do. I would imagine that they are too overloaded. And I imagine there's also similar sort of resistance that you've been talking about there among college students, that this is something that's quite not understood. It's something that they're not as familiar with, that they're used to doing, and so on. Now, they may take a psychology class, and they may have a professor that talks about this in some way, maybe opens up one's mind to that, and that's all good and well. That needs to happen. So when and if, as you mentioned before about mental health becoming more of an issue that we begin to talk about,
we are talking.
Yes, we are.
More, which is a good thing.
How are we talking about it? How does I'm sorry. What's Osaka's first name again?
Naomi. Osaka.
How do we perceive Naomi here? Is she in her discussion of her emotional problems? There's all sorts of reaction by the other tennis pros. Some pro, some con.
Right.
It. So it's you know, how much is she able or willing to go into what it is that's really bothering her?
Well, nor does she.
Exactly.
Nor does she. I mean, look, right. She dropped out of several tournaments. And of course,
that's
Naomi
was
that's her own business. She said that she was having her own issues. And I think it was really an important thing and a very gutsy thing for her to do.
I agree.
To come out. But of course, Naomi Osaka would not have to worry about how she would pay for private therapy, which is another issue. And when I was citing the example of my 15-year-old patient, the young girl that I'm treating, who was on a waiting list, and she comes from a middle-class family, and here she is on a waiting list at a child center, psychiatric center in the Hamptons, and in the meantime had made a couple of suicide gestures. Well, very, very concerning.
Let's mention also for just a couple of minutes, suicide rates and homicide rates in the prisons at Rikers. And a lot of them are young kids, too. I mean, again, my God, the sort of treatment and help that needs to be gotten there is just, it's totally lacking. So at every level, wherever you're talking about, whatever class level, racial, ethnic level, there's a void in many cases.
Well, you know, when I think back to my years as a school social worker in the Montreal school system, and then I became one of three directors for the entire school social services program for Greater Montreal, I began in the inner city school gym. And everybody knew that there was a school social worker and a school psychologist, and it was all okay. I mean, we were a part of a team. We were a part of the guidance counselor and the teacher and the principal and the vice principal.
BDB, if I may, that's great. That's much more to the ideal. But you know what? In New York City public schools, and much of what has been brought in is the police. Okay, those are the initial contact, and it's punishment, and that is being
it's
practiced.
Punishment, yes, yes,
and so there are good people within the school system, of course, and good counselors and so on, but they're also up against a system that is making these kids desperate and crazy as well.
Well, I think it's also a commitment on the part of the government and the Department of Education to make sure that there is sufficient funding. I mean, we never, of course, in Canada, we were never worried about funding. If we needed to have another school social worker that needed to be hired, then that was the way it was done. There wasn't a concern about that.
And but we still don't know about what happened to the mental health money that was allocated for the De Blasio.
No, we certainly don't.
Still don't.
As I had multiple attempts at trying to reach the mayor's office and his wife to talk about exactly this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, as we all know, children spend the majority of their time in school.
Yep.
And it is the most logical place in the world to be able to help them access mental health services. And I think that we need, and I think it's starting more and more, to kind of make mental health and mental health access kind of cool. And I would like to see, since there is this, you know, real
rather
concern,
than stigmatize, I get your point.
Yes, to make it cool. And we have Michael Phelps, and we have more and more celebrities who are doing commercials on television and who are coming out and talking about their own mental health issues and making it okay and even cool to talk about our issues.
Well, maybe Michael Phelps, and that again, but we're talking still about hardcore young kids in inner city schools where to survive, you have to be pretty macho and pretty strong and violent if you need to. And so that's a lot to break down. And
but the schools, if there was a really big major commitment in the schools in terms of really highlighting the importance of mental health treatment, I think these, you know, tough, in quotes, kids, there would be a relief that they would know, A, that it is okay and that you can still be tough and you can still learn to express your feelings and go for help if there is a need. That
I agree.
Be all okay.
I agree. But one other thing I'd like to add, I know we're running out of time, is that the kids themselves, I'm thinking of the show I just did with Filippo Luciano on the Young Lords.
Right.
The impetus for this should also come from the community and the community kids themselves who can organize the transformation of this sort of thinking that you're talking about. It's not just about a celebrity or about a so-called expert coming in. And it's not just about throwing money at this stuff too. So it is about the community and reaching out and solidarity. And these other kids who maybe have gone through a gang experience, now realizing how dead end that might have been and destructive it might have been, also coming into the schools and talking about their
There was a recent article that I read by AOC, and she wrote a really good article on burnout. And again, people in, you know, some of these more marginal communities who are in leadership positions, they need to speak out and they need to talk about, you know, my own burnout and my own therapy.
Not AOC, please.
She talked about her own burnout and what she'd have to be burned out with everything that she's doing. And that we need to find a way. We need to find a way to make it okay, whether you're black or white or gay or straight or trans or Jewish or Christian or Muslim, to make it okay to reach out and ask for help. And if we need to make it cool, then that's what we need to do a better job in doing.
And you know what? Words to the therapists, educate yourself about these cultures and train yourself.
Absolutely.
And not just relocate yourself to some upper middle class population here.
Absolutely.
And be good. Be good therapists.
We all
need them.
Be sensitive, be aware,
and get
out of your bubble. That is for sure. Well, listen, thanks again,
Jim
Rattle, sociologist,
right,
host of the Radical Imagination on MMI. You know, my listeners are going to be very upset with me today because I had promised everybody that I was going to be talking about also effective marriage counseling, my unique approach, which I'm going to have to talk about next week. I apologize, everybody, but I think this was a really important discussion to have.
And I don't think they're that upset. And if they are, they can bring it to their therapist.
Well, or they can email me or text
or
me and
let
me know that I broke my promise. But I think this was a really important discussion.
Thank you.
Well, everybody, it is 3:58 and I don't know where the time went and came and gone today. And I hope that you found this discussion with Jim Broaddus and myself really informative and important. And it's very easy to just try to bury our heads and pretend that these issues don't exist only in other homes and in other communities. And yet I think it's really important to talk about the truth and what's really happening in today's society. Well, I'm going to leave you with my two weekly messages. And of course, the first message which is that we need to do everything that we can possibly do to be mindful of navigating our lives in ways that are in our best interest every single day. And secondly, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to care for each other and learning to love each other. So goodbye, everybody. Have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving and be good to yourself. And if your family makes you crazy, then only stay for 10 or 15 minutes. So again, have a good rest of the day and I'll talk with you next week. Bye-bye.